This episode is brought to you by Ratani. Looking for an engagement ring? Check out Ratani. Shop online and your ring is made in New York and sent to you or a local jeweler. It's that easy. Go to Ratani, RITNIA.com/sports today for their free diamond giveaway.
For me, the kind of stories that I'm writing, I'm trying to spend a really significant amount of time with the people I'm writing about. So there's also something about just trusting your interpersonal instincts when you've started to talk to somebody and you can tell they're comfortable. I can tell that I'm interested, that I want to know more. And that's sort of the moment when I know I want to get on the plane.
Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each week we interview a member of the sports media. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. My producer is Alan Kim. And this week our guest is the Washington Post writer and reporter, Eli Saslow, one of the really great journalists in this country. He's won the Pulitzer Prize for his work, and I looked up when the Washington Post editors wrote the letter applying for that year's Pulitzer Prize. I think they correctly said one of Eli Saslow's greatest skills as a journalist is his ability to transform the most complicated subjects into stories that are understandable and deeply affecting. Eli won the Pulitzer Prize for his work in 2013, writing about the U.S.'s food stamp program, which has tripled in size over the last decade and now reaches around 50 million Americans. And these are the kind of stories that Eli does. He goes to different towns in this country and really examines the stories that are happening there. He's done a lot with tragedy too, from mass shootings in San Bernardino, Newtown, Roseburg, Oregon, and we're taping this one day after the worst mass shooting in this country's history in Orlando. And I'll certainly ask him about how do you get people to open up on what is essentially the worst thing that's ever happened to them. And Eli's got a great ability to do that, whether he's talking to families about poverty or about tragedy. His work is really just impressive. He is on this podcast because there is a corollary of sports in that he works for ESPN, the magazine, and has done many, many features for them, whether it's on Daniel Norris. I think he's written about LeBron, wrote a great piece about these two high school kids in northern Louisiana. One kid delivered a tackle on a high school football game, and the other kid ended up dying. I don't know if he died on the field, but he ended up dying from that hit. And Eli did an examination of, you know, what happens to that kid, the kid who just in the midst of a football game caused this, and obviously not intentionally, but, you know, how do you come back from that? And that's a story well worth checking out on ESPN, the magazine, if you haven't. So I'm really excited to have Eli Saslow as our guest today on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. I think you would really enjoy the conversation. He is in the Pacific Northwest, beautiful city of Portland, Oregon, which I've been to once and enjoyed the food trucks there. Eli Saslow, welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad you've been here before. I don't think one visit is enough to do justice to the Portland food trucks, though. You need like 3 years of your life to tour the food trucks here.
Then, no doubt. Then head over to Voodoo Donuts for a nightcap.
And a long line.
Yeah, no doubt. All right, Eli, I'm excited to have you on, and I want to start off with something very basic. You strikes me that you have a lot of freedom at both the Washington Post and ESPN when it comes to story selection. And so how do you choose your stories? And more importantly, why do you choose your stories?
Yeah, that's a really, that's a great question. And something that I spend obviously a lot of time thinking about, because you're right. I have a really lucky, fortunate situation, like both with the Post and ESPN, and that I get a lot of latitude in terms of what I write about. And I also, I get a lot of time to spend on the stories that I write. So these are oftentimes, you know, project type stories that range from a couple weeks to a couple months or more. And so I want to make sure when I commit to doing a story that it's going to work out. I mean, sort of the pressure in my job is not necessarily to be writing all the time or to be breaking news, but the pressure is that when I'm writing, the stories merit sort of the space and the time that these places are committing to them. So, you know, I mean, the most basic thing I'm doing in both places is I'm trying to find, what are the big things that are happening in the country, and what are the ways to turn those into stories that can be felt? So usually that's looking at these really big issues and trying to find a way to make them small. I mean, where's the place I can go? Who's the person I can spend time with to illuminate something big that's happening in the country or in sport, depending on what the topic is. So, it's that part of the process is probably where I spend half my reporting time. I mean, it's like I'll have an initial notion for what a story might be, and then it might take me a week or 2 weeks of making calls and thinking that 10 or 15 different people are going to be the right person to write about. And only realizing at the end that actually, it's this person in this place and I need to go at this time. So the stories, the stories miss and change many times in the process, but it's just, hopefully I'm having those misses before I get on the plane to go somewhere to start actually reporting kind of on site.
This is kind of a sort of amorphous question, but how do you know when you have found the right subject?
Yeah, I mean, I think the most guttural thing is I get excited about it or moved by it or, I'm eager to tell people about it. I think for me, the kind of stories that I'm writing, I'm trying to spend a really significant amount of time with the people I'm writing about. So there's also something about just trusting your interpersonal instincts when you've started to talk to somebody and you can tell they're comfortable. I can tell that I'm interested, that I want to know more. And that's sort of the moment when I know I want to get on the plane. The other thing I would say is that for me writing, these really narrative stories, which I think of as stories that are heavy on observed scene and dialogue, stories where I'm not just interviewing people, I'm also sort of trying to blend into their life at key moments. I mean, one thing that's super important for me on every story is I want to make sure that I'm there when something is happening. I want to be able to be there to watch something unfold and hopefully to watch sort of tension and resolution take place. So I'm organizing these trips over key moments in people's lives. So it's not just looking for the right people, but it's looking to be with them at a moment when I can sort of watch something happen to them or watch them try to make something happen so that their focus is not always going to be on me. Like they're going to be paying more attention to what they're trying to accomplish, what they're trying to do. And hopefully I'll be able to at times kind of fade into the background and just watch.
Eli, I'll eventually get to the news side after we talk a little bit about sports, but as a general guideline, how many sports-centric pieces do you write a year?
I think the last 3 or 4 years, it's been about 5 or 6, and all, usually my pieces are maybe 3,000 to 6,000 words, somewhere in that range.
I've read a lot of what you've written, whether it's Daniel Norris, the two high schoolers who in Louisiana who came together on a fateful play, one tackler, one kid who was tackled. Is there a common theme in the sports stories that you do, or is it simply a case of you find these particular subjects or themes interesting?
Yeah, I'm not sure. It's a good question. I'm not sure that there's a common theme that I'm necessarily looking to pursue from one story to the next. But I think what I am looking for in any story, a sports story or not, is a story that can resonate sort of with people who might not be interested in the topic. So you mentioned that football story, which was about two high school kids who'd collided on a play and one of them had died. That's a story that's pretty squarely about the kid who felt like he killed the other kid in that collision and what it's like to come back from something like that. And in that case, it's a story that's, where sort of the core of it is not football. And I think that's probably true in almost every story that I write. It's also true in the stories that I write for the Washington Post, where I'm hoping that I'm not, my story might have political undertones or politics might be part of what's happening, but hopefully they're not for political audiences. I think like I'm trying in every story to tap into something that's a little bit more universal where people can kind of identify into what the characters are dealing with.
Who, whether you're going to do this or not, and obviously you're not going to give away some story you're working on or you may work on, but when you look at the sports landscape, what would be an interesting story to you, whether it is a specific subject or a specific theme?
Oh, geez. I mean, there are so many. But yeah, I mean, I think so. One recent example is for a long time, I'd been trying to write about something about LeBron that felt new, and that's that's a huge challenge because LeBron is first of all, access with him is really difficult, and that's not unusual in sports. Access is always difficult, and so I was trying to find a way to sort of illuminate some piece of him that might feel new, and also to write about, frame him in Cleveland in some way. And so Cleveland had this really terrible year for gun violence, and I'd been paying attention to that for the Post and sort of thinking about gun stuff. And then I noticed that, after these three really terrible crossfire shootings that had killed infants in a month, LeBron had tweeted about one of them. And just out of curiosity, I followed up with the father of the kid who died that LeBron had tweeted about. And it turned out that, LeBron and his father had, over the course of the year, had this sort of back and forth relationship where both of them were navigating through this year and where Cleveland was sort of in this really unsteady moment. And it just felt like that could be something, something bigger, something that they would show LeBron maybe in this little different light, but also might say something about Cleveland and about what's happening in that city. So I think what I look for in sports is stories that are sort of scalable, where like you can look at something that feels small, but if you're able to sort of look at it from these different angles, it can feel bigger. And if you have that, that takes you a long way. I mean, I think it's the same thing with the Daniel Norris story, which you mentioned, which is about this professional pitcher who signed $1 million-plus contract and then decided to live during spring training in the parking lot of a Walmart in his van. That's a story that seems sort of silly at first brush, but really it's about all these things that people identify with, like wanderlust and what you want in your life and not feeling restrained by like different ways people identify you. And so I think like it's about finding ways to get a story that you can push into some kind of universal place.
Eli, how do you specifically write? Do you transcribe all your interviews, put them on a laptop, and then try to put the puzzle together? Or is your process different? And if it is, what is it?
Yeah, sometimes I do that. I mean, it really depends. If I'm reporting a story, In like the ideal way I'd like to report it, I'm spending too much time with the people I'm writing about to tape everything. So, say Daniel Norris, in that story, I'm saying I want to talk to you about living in this van, but really what I want to do is I want to come and for 5-6 days while you're in spring training, I want to be with you at the van all the time. Like I'm not going to sleep there. I'll get a hotel nearby, but I'm going to be there when you wake up and you do like your weird stretching routine on the Walmart grocery carts. I'm going to be there while you're cooking breakfast on your stove. And so what happens is after a while, they stop sort of paying attention to you all the time. Like Daniel gets used to me being there. And instead of sort of presenting a certain version of himself, for a story, he's just hopefully being himself more and more because he's comfortable. And so, in that situation, I'm taping in select instances when we're like sitting down and sort of, I'm really, just doing more of a formal interview with him. But most of the time I've got a notebook in my hand, I have a pen and I'm sort of filling notebook after notebook. And then when I come home, I'm going through all those notebooks, indexing them, usually spending a couple days thinking about structure and having a pretty good outline, like scene to scene, and certainly knowing where I'm ending a story before I start to write.
You know, once upon a time, Eli, when you were first at the Post, you were covering high school volleyball for a D.C. suburb, I believe. And so that's obviously not a beat where you're going to be doing the kind of reporting that you eventually did. There's a lot of young people in the media business who listen to this podcast. Did you have a plan in mind as to how you would get from that point to where you are now? Did it just evolve naturally? Because there are a lot of very talented people who, you know, may be doing high school sports right now and may not, for whatever reason, ever end up getting to the place that you got. So how did it happen for you?
Totally. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, some of it is certainly luck. You know, I mean, the one thing that I would say is that I had a pretty clear idea that even when I was writing about high school volleyball at the Post, I knew that I wanted to write stories about people. And I knew that I was interested in writing narrative stories that were observed and you know, where I was writing in a longer form. And the Post, you know, it did not, the Post has been great to me in many ways, but the Post did not, they weren't super interested in facilitating that for high school volleyball, beat writer in Anne Arundel County. So what I did was I sort of did those stories on my own time. And, you know, I think I did it less for, reasons of like, career development or aspiration, although definitely there was some of that, but one of the main reasons I did it was because like that was why I'd wanted to be a journalist in the first place. And I think sometimes, like, you know, especially now, journalism and certainly print journalism, it can be a sort of unforgiving work environment. And I think people who are going into it, like, we can't assume necessarily that like employers will pave the way to the careers that we want. And so it's really, really important to, this will sound like cheesy, but to sort of nurture your soul a little bit. Like, you, if you're not sometimes doing the kind of stories that you wanted to become a journalist for, you're not going to last very long in journalism. It can become crushing really quickly. If it feels like every story you're doing is a story you're only doing because you're being assigned it or you're doing it for a job. So, you know, for me, like on the outside of that time, I had to find a way to sometimes do stories for me, and they really were for me. Like, nobody had assigned them. I wouldn't even tell the editors really what I was working on until I had a story that was finished. And at the beginning, they sort of looked at those stories and said, like, really? Like, why'd you do this? Like, well, we'll see if we can find space for it. And you know, over time, they started to like those stories, and they started to make a little bit more time in my job for me to do those stories. And then, you know, my job for the last decade has basically just been those stories. And that's a really lucky way for it to have transpired. But I think, like, the beginning of it was, I knew that I'd gone into journalism to write a certain kind of story, and I wasn't going to keep doing it if I never got to write those stories.
One of the things you mentioned before was about calling people and talking to people so you can find the right subject. You know, there's a lot of television news people who are very famous for writing glowing letters to try to get the big get, Barbara Walters, Diane Sawyer, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You have written letters to subjects to try to get them to talk to you. What has been your approach in that kind of letter writing? How do you get somebody to talk to you that may have no experience ever talking to a media person?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and I think, like, the you know, at the core of any good story, whether you're writing about somebody famous or somebody who's never been written about before, is trust, and building that trust with the person you're writing about really quickly, and that's not a trust that's built on, hey, I'm going to portray you in a positive light, or hey, this story is going to be good for you. It's a kind of trust that, for me anyway, is built through explaining to somebody, I'm going to do every last thing that I can do to get the story right and to do justice to what it is that you're dealing with, what you're going through, and to write about it in a way that somebody who doesn't know you, somebody who doesn't understand your circumstances, is going to read it and feel in some small way for at least a few moments that they might understand a little bit of what that's like. And you know, that's a pitch that goes a long way for people. I mean, I think all people, famous, not famous, whatever, like they want to be understood. they want to feel like their experiences matter. They want to feel like they're not going through something that doesn't resonate. So, you know, when you can tell somebody that you think that what they're going through does matter, and you think that it's important enough to, you know, pay incredibly close attention to, you know, that really ingratiates you to people. And I think that's basically my pitch for every story.
All right. Anyone who's married or thinking about getting married knows all about the anxiousness when it comes to figuring out how to get that ring, what that ring should be, not to mention the proposal and everything else. A lot of anxiety there. Now, if you're thinking about proposing, it's a great idea. We wish you luck. But what are you going to do about the ring? So if a proposal is in the cards for you, you need to check out Ritani. All of their rings are handcrafted in New York. You shop online, and they'll ship it to you overnight or to a Ritani jeweler that's close to you. If it's not exactly right, you can return it with no hassle. This is ring shopping on your own terms, no pressure, no pushy salespeople. You design a ring on Ritani's easy-to-use website, they handcraft it, and you choose to get it delivered to your home or to a jeweler near you. It's that simple. You get the perfect ring, and you feel great about doing it. And this month, Ritani is giving away a diamond. Very nice, Alan Kim, a diamond. Just visit Ritani, RITANI.com/sports, today for the free diamond giveaway. That's Ritani.com/sports. Good luck in your quest for a diamond. All right, Eli, as we switch to the news stories that you've done, the narrative work that you've done over the years, Orlando is unfortunately in the news as we tape this. We're one day removed from the worst mass shooting in this country's history. And you have covered these events in San Bernardino, Roseburg, Oregon, Newtown. You're a reporter who has unfortunately worked this terrain, and I say unfortunately because it exists. And so I'm really, and this was when I asked people on Twitter for some questions for you, this sort of really came up a lot. And I think people want to know, how do you go about approaching conversations and reporting with people who have experienced this kind of profound loss, this kind of profound heartbreak, this kind of profound tragedy? What is your approach to try to get a survivor of a shooting, as you did in Oregon, to talk to you?
You know, I think a lot of it is about the moment that you approach people. You know, I'm not in Orlando right now. And, you know, if I go, it would be later. Because right now, you know, anybody who's at the center of these things is so overwhelmed. They're getting called by so many people. And it's really hard in these moments to get to a place where you can build that trust that I was talking about, because it's too chaotic of a moment. And it's really hard to cut through that as a reporter. You know, I think it's important that we try. It's obviously important that we cover this stuff, but I think, like, we have to sort of be honest about, you know, the coverage in this moment is more about an event than it is about sort of like the deeply felt personal experience of what it's like to go through one of these things. So, you know, I've had much more success in circling back later. You know, I think in both Newtown and in Oregon, you know, I went back a few months later to sort of try to get a little bit closer to the experience of what it feels like to be at the center of one of these things. You know, and then when I'm approaching people, I'm helped in part, frankly, by how unbelievably quick our news cycle has become. Because for the people at the center of these, they understand, just as we all understand, how this is going to play out. It's going to be on the news for 3 days. It'll be everything we're talking about for 3 days. And unfortunately, in this country, in this moment, in 3 weeks, there's going to be another. And Orlando will sort of start to fade a little bit, and then there'll be another, and it'll fade a little bit more. And so what I say to people oftentimes is, look, everybody it's important that we still pay attention. What's happening in this place is still important. It hasn't ended for the people who are at the middle of it. And you know, everything about I think our attention span, our news cycle, sort of tempts us to look away because it's a little bit easier to do. But I think sometimes what's more important is to stare hard at the thing that's really difficult to look at, which is how unbelievably devastating these things are long-term at the epicenter of them. No matter how many times we say, you know, Roseburg strong or Orlando strong, I think I've seen now on Twitter, like it's, you know, we can hope and pray as much as we want and have as many vigils as we want, but eventually, like, we move on, and the people at the center of them don't have the luxury of doing that. And I think that's been a, you know, that's been a conversation that I've had before these stories with people in those places that's resonated enough that they've felt comfortable letting me in. And then, of course, like with any story, you know, the first hour you show up is a little bit awkward, and they're nervous, and you as a reporter, even if you've done it 100 times before, you're a little bit nervous. You know, the first day is a little bit like that, but then the second day is easier, and the third day is easier, and you know, the second trip is easier, and eventually, you know, people just get very comfortable having you around. But there's no shortcut on time spent, I think, on these stories. Like, there's sort of a reporting equation that's like, however long you can have an interview last, whether it's, you know, if you have 30 minutes with somebody, like, the second 15 minutes should be a lot better than the first 15 minutes. And the same holds true for weeks, because the more comfortable people get, the more willing they are to sort of reveal themselves to you.
I read an interview with you where you were talking about some of the things that you do that maybe people wouldn't realize to try to make subjects comfortable, especially subjects who, again, are talking about really hard things, whether it's tragedy, whether it's poverty. And you mentioned that you'll eat at the places they want to eat. And this was interesting to me, that you will dress in a manner that is comfortable to them, which I took as you're not showing up, if you're doing a story on food stamps, in a suit. You know, you're going to do your best to be as I'm not saying you're going to dress up as whatever your subjects dress up as, but you're not going to provide a visual image where there's a separation between you and the subject. So this is my interpretation, but you are consciously thinking of these things, correct, as you go about the reporting of your stories, depending on who you are reporting a story on?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I mean, the one thing that I would say is, you know, I think it's important not to think of it as like costuming or as playing a part, because I'm not doing either of those things. I'm in fact, like, the reason that I'm sort of, you know, I'm not wearing a suit and tie, and I'm not, you know, I'm not only eating at nice restaurants, is because I want them to feel comfortable. Like, I want, you know, when I go into these places, I'm the visitor in their world, and I want to make clear in every single way that I can, through words and through actions, that I'm not there. I'm not coming there from a place of judgment. Like, I'm coming there from a place of, I want to understand everything I can about what it's like to be you. And so, yeah, that means, living on their schedule a little bit and eating where they want to eat and, you know, making them feel comfortable in their places. And I think, you know, a lot of it is really just, paying full attention to people. I mean, like, I've had times before where I've taken my phone in with me when I'm reporting, or you know, it happened once when I was in Roseburg and in this house where this daughter who's still just a physical and psychological mess from being shot in this classroom in Oregon, and her mom are sitting in this room, and I have my phone on me, and I'm sitting in there hour after hour, and sometimes it gets slow, and, like, you're tempted to pull out your phone and pull up Twitter or look at what's going on, and I've done that before, and in that moment, like, you're signaling to the people that you're writing about that something you have going on, something I have going on in my own life, is more important than what they're telling me, and you know, that can cut to trust so quickly. I think it's really just the act of paying full attention and really being genuinely curious, and the genuine part is important because you can't fake that. Like you have to really be curious about people, and hopefully you also have to be feeling a little bit of what they're going through. Because if you're hoping to translate emotion to the page, like in a written way, if I want readers to feel some piece of an experience, then like I sure better feel some part of it too, because otherwise, like, there's no chance.
The you mentioned the 16-year-old girl at the time, Cheyenne Fitzgerald, who was struggling. She would have been shot on her fourth day of college, and you know, clearly she was. The piece was called "A Survivor's Life," and clearly she was sort of struggling with that post-traumatic, post-traumatic things that she was dealing with. I remember the story that you wrote on the struggling swimming pool salesman, and that sort of, I think, illustrated the daily toll of the economic downturn. One of the things, Eli, that these pieces consistently have is a lot of in-depth dialogue from your subjects. And this is always a question. It's probably a question Bob Woodward used to get is how do you do that? How do you, if you're not taping everything, how do you get the intricate dialogue that your subjects are saying with their families or with their friends?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think it's something that takes a good bit of practice. I mean, one, you know, in the most basic way, one thing that I think it's really important for a reporter to do is sometimes to get comfortable being quiet and to get comfortable sort of sitting in a space that might feel a little bit awkward. Like I think as journalists, we get really used to asking the questions, and that's sort of how we make ourselves comfortable when we're reporting. But sometimes, like, it's just as valuable to sit and be quiet and let things happen around you. So that's one thing that I really try to do. And just much more basically, like, I think dialogue in my stories is always, it's pretty short. Like it's a sentence or two, it's like exchanged with another sentence or two. And partly that's just because I can't keep up beyond that. It gets really hard in a notebook to keep up, and if I have any doubt or uncertainty about what was said, then I go back and I check with both people in that conversation to make sure that what I wrote down is right and I've got it right. But I think a lot of it is also, you sort of train your ear to be ready to anticipate moments of dialogue. So for me, oftentimes, like being in a car, if I'm with two people I'm writing about, I always sit in the back seat of the car. They can kind of forget about me. I fade out a little bit, and they're talking to each other in the front seat, and that's a moment where oftentimes it's like a really good opportunity for dialogue. And then it's just in putting yourself in reporting situations where there are things going on that are important enough that the people you're reporting on have, like, they're working on those things and not working on trying to sort of impress or appease you. So going with people to doctor's appointments or to court or to, whatever might be happening in their lives, where they're forced to sort of pay attention to something else. And that, by the very nature of those things, that means dialogue is happening. And I think, like, scene and dialogue is so important in stories because, my hope is that, in what I'd hope for my best work, like, people hopefully come away from a story that has a lot of scene and dialogue and they feel like they've seen something for themselves. It's like the story has walked them up to this clear pane of glass and they felt like they were stepping into this room and seeing these things happen. And that's, I think that's a really powerful kind of journalism, because right now we have, we have a lot of journalism that is really good at telling us what we should think, or opinion, or even analysis. And it's very different if you can give a reader the experience where they feel like they're seeing something for themselves. The conclusions that they draw from that, I think, stay with them longer. I think that things that we feel like we learned for ourselves, rather than things that we're told, they last a little bit longer in our minds. And I think that's what scene and dialogue has the power of achieving.
You won the Pulitzer Prize for a series on the role and shortcomings of food stamps in a post-recession America. And one of the questions I wanted to ask you was, how, as a journalist, can you, or how do you try to relate to someone who lives on food stamps when you clearly and your socioeconomic means are not on food stamps. And that's, you know, journalists, obviously, their job is to report accurately or as best as they can what their subject is. But there really is a difference between what they're going through and what you're going through. So how do you try to bridge the gap? Because you've done a lot of work on the middle, the declining middle class of America, and the what used to be the middle class maybe falling into the lower middle class or poverty levels. And
sure.
So I just wonder how you, as someone, being honest, you're not in that class as a Washington Post reporter, but you've done a lot of really good work on it. So how do you bridge that gap between your reality and their reality?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question, I think, not just about journalism, but about, you know, our country now and the way that it works. And that, like, we're really siloed, right? Like, we, whether it's by race, by class, by interest, by political party, like, we tend to spend time with people who think like we do, which I think is sort of a dangerous and scary thing on a lot of levels. But I think for me, like, a big part of relating across all those groups is not pretending that I identify with that experience from any sort of personal way. Like, I don't know what it's like to not have enough food to eat. And in those conversations and in those houses, I'm really honest about that. Like, in fact, I'm here because I don't know what it's like. And rather than me tell people what I think it might be like, I want them to hear what it's like from you. And I want them to see what it's like from spending a day in this house with you and understanding what it's like to be waiting for the lunch bus to roll around for the one meal a day that you might get to eat. And I think if you're honest about that, like if you start from a place of honesty, like, I don't know what this is like, that's a lot better than sort of pretending that you understand or relate personally to those experiences. So, you know, I try to be pretty transparent about that.
I want to eventually get to, we'll finish up with your book on the letters that people sent to the president. And you interviewed President Obama for that. It was really pretty interesting. But before that, Eli, one of the things that has struck me about your career is you don't seem interested at all in television. And that's interesting to me because there's a lot of people of your generation, I think you're in your early 30s if I'm right about that, who have a sports background, who see that as the goal, or if nothing else, and perhaps smartly, see that as a lucrative goal, because if you go on TV in sports and particularly say something controversial or contrarian or loud, you could be rewarded pretty lucratively. But you have made the option and the decision to seemingly go the exact opposite way. Why did television, or why has television not seemingly been something that's calling you or desire for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, first of all, it's probably part of it is I've been lucky in that, you know, like the writing has worked out well enough that I haven't felt a need to do that, and, you know, financially or for whatever other reason. Like, if I was still writing high school volleyball capsules in Anne Arundel and ESPN was asking me to go on TV, probably that would be a lot more tempting. But I think, you know, I think there's a lot of value to that kind of work. But for me, what I feel sort of like my, you know, my North Star is in like this kind of stuff is I want to do stories that are about, I want to do work that's about the people that I'm writing about. And I don't want the work to be, about putting myself at the center of something. And so for the kind of stories that I'm doing, like my hope is that people walk away thinking about the story and the people in the story and not necessarily thinking about me. And I think, you know, that's TV obviously is different that way. Like I don't, and the other thing is I don't know enough. I'm not opinionated enough. And I'm not good enough at arguing or debating, to necessarily like want to put myself in that place. And I think I really appreciate the fact that these kind of stories that I get to sweat over and think about every sentence. And, you know, for that reason, when one of these stories comes out and, you know, I practically have them memorized because I've gone over every sentence so many times, I've chosen the words so carefully and, you know, and that's a hugely fortunate amount of time to have in this kind of job. But, you know, to go from that to, here's 45 seconds, hit your live spot and make your point, I think that's a transition that would be really difficult for me.
For someone who is 10 years old or 15 years old in this country, young girl, young boy, do you believe that what you do will exist 25 years from now? Will there be a forum for them to do the kind of work you're doing now?
I sure hope so. I mean, but and yes, I do. I do believe that there will, because, you know, if anything, I think I've seen and I've noticed that these kind of stories, they resonate more than when I started writing them. Maybe some of that, hopefully, is that I've gotten better at writing, so the stories have gotten better. But I think part of it is, like, there's, like, we want the opportunity to visit, like, other parts of the country and other people's lives and opinions. And you know, I think there's a little bit of, like, a backlash to how short the news cycle has become and how, you know, like, and a backlash on certainty, I'd say. Like, another thing about whether it's TV or whether it's a lot of sort of really quick sort of take-driven journalism is, there's a sense that we have to be certain about everything, and we have to have, like, a strong opinion about every single thing. And I think, like, readers and audiences crave nuance, and that's a little bit more honest to how life is lived. Like we're not always sure about that. In fact, some of the big intractable problems in our country continue to be big intractable problems because there aren't easy answers, and it's really complicated, and nobody's really certain about a lot of this stuff. So I think journalism, whether television journalism, print journalism, radio journalism, that honors those complexities and the nuance, it's popular, and I think will continue to be popular.
With the 2016 NBA draft fast approaching, I think we know who the first two picks are, but after that, it's going to be open. SI's NBA podcast, Open Floor, is bringing you a special draft episode, 30 picks, 5 experts, and the best mock draft you'll hear on the web. So that's the Open Floor podcast. Find it on iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcast app of choice, as well as SI.com/podcasts. Eli, a couple of years ago, you did a book titled 10 Letters, The Stories Americans Tell Their President. And correct me if I'm wrong on this, but the premise of the book is that President Obama, whether it's daily, weekly, or monthly, I should know this that I don't, but he reads 10 letters from Americans and writes them back. And the letters are selected somewhere, and there must be a collection of or a compilation of all sorts of different letters from people, who are, I imagine, pro the president, anti the president. And correct me when you answer this question if I've described that horribly, which I might have. But how did you first come across the letters that are sent to the president of the United States?
Yeah, so you had it right. I mean, the White House has, like, a gigantic office of presidential correspondence, and they, you know, I think they get something like 20,000 letters and emails a day, and they go through a ridiculously metrics-driven process to categorize all that mail by, you know, what it's about, positive, negative, whatever else, and they use those metrics to, at the end of the day, deliver, 10 letters to the president's desk in the Oval Office. I heard about that. There was a time at the Post where, you know, I was really shortly after Obama took office, where my job was to try to, illuminate his life in any way that I could. And that's, like, it's a really difficult thing to do. One similarity between sports and politics is that, like, you're oftentimes left trying to write about people that you have pretty limited access to, and also people who are consumed by winning. It's sort of the same both ways. But, you know, I wasn't going to be getting a lot of time, to hang out with President Obama in the White House and like report the way that I usually report. So I was looking for these different sort of ways to sort of show a little bit about what his life was like. And so he started talking about these letters that he reads every day. And so I spent a lot of time going back and forth through the White House to try to get access to the 10 letters that he reads every night, and also to the responses that he writes to people. He usually writes one or two letters back a day. And then the book ended up being the story of 10 of those exchanges through the mail over the course of a year. Because oftentimes, like, he, you know, the letters echo in big ways in terms of policy. Like, they'll, you know, one letter, he really sort of built a lot of his healthcare push around. Other letters, he'll talk about in speeches. Some of these letter writers then will come to the White House, and we'll spend time having these exchanges with him. And so the book is the story of 10 of these over the course of the year.
When you did finally get a chance to sit down with Barack Obama, and I think you interviewed him on this for half hour. So was that the first time you'd interviewed the President of the United States?
Yeah, it was. And it was the first time I'd been in the Oval Office. Going back to what you wear for interviews, that was the rare interview where I wore a suit. Dusted out of the closet.
Right.
It's an intimidating experience. And I'm a very casual interviewer. I'm a pretty casual person. I find that works pretty well for me. I think in general, in terms of interviewing, like, it's really good to pattern your own interviewing after your own style, like, and to not try to force something that doesn't feel like you. And for me, you know, that means being pretty casual. And so it was difficult for me to have an interview at the Oval Office, because that's not a casual place. Like, when you go to the White House, when you're interviewing the President in the Oval Office, there's like a series of waiting rooms that you go through. So, like, first you go into the White House general waiting room, and there are a ton of people in there. You don't feel particularly nervous. Like, people are meeting with all different kinds of people. And then they move you into this West Wing waiting room, which, like, is smaller. There are maybe, like, three or four people in there. You recognize most of them. There are a bunch of Secret Service officers. And then they move you into the Oval waiting room, which is not really a room. It's just, like, one chair surrounded by, like, seven Secret Service officers. And you start to sweat through your shirt pretty quickly. That's kind of how it went. And then, you know, President Obama just came out himself and grabbed me. And most interviews, the first 5 minutes was, like, a little bit nerve-wracking. I think I'd made a mistake by trying to sort of script my questions, which is not something I normally do. But I felt like I should, because it was the president. And I realized, you know, within the first 2 or 3 minutes, like, that's not the way that I do things well. And then it became a really free-flowing conversation for like 35 minutes or so. And one nice advantage of doing an interview in the Oval Office is that there's a transcriptionist who basically stays in the Oval Office, like, all the time, because everything that's said in that room is written down for the presidential record. So if you don't have your tape recorder, you're okay, because the transcriptionist is there for you.
My sense is, you know, I don't want to speak for you, but my sense is you would ultimately prefer the immersion of being with a family in Indiana or Oregon for a couple of days, as opposed to the White House for 30 minutes, because you really can get close to the subjects on the former, where at the latter, all presidential politics is a little bit staged. So that's my sense.
Sure.
It's interesting that you got to, that you in your journalism career have experienced both, but it's really dramatic to me, the kind of stuff that you do in the living room of someone's home versus being in the living room of Barack Obama.
Yeah, I mean, I think I think your instinct is right. I mean, I think both kinds of journalism are incredibly valuable. Like, I think that we need to chronicle every moment of any president in office, because that's a super important thing for the country to know about. But I think that for me, like, where I'm, where my skills are better suited, and also just where the place that I'm drawn to more is the place where I can spend more time, and where I can sort of be a little bit more immersed in kind of the lived experience in somebody's life.
Well, Eli, this has been really interesting, and I appreciate, you know, we don't often on this podcast have people who cross over to to news, but I'm a great admirer of your work, and you're really one of the people in the business who seamlessly crosses over to very high-level sports writing, in addition to the obvious important work that you do for the Post on these long-form projects. So I appreciate you giving us some time today on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, and I wish you nothing but the best success heading forward. I do know that a long time ago, you wanted to work here, and naturally our employer screwed up and did not hire you, so I apologize for that as well.
I'm not sure that was a screw up. That might be the reason you guys continue to put out so much.
No, it's a screw up. I'll be the first to say. But you've overcome that. So I'm very happy that you've overcome not working here to win the Pulitzer Prize and other things.
Well, I appreciate it. I think it still is a pretty phenomenal place to work, and luckily for me as a reader, it's a phenomenal thing to read.
That's nice of you to say.
I'll keep reading. Yeah, appreciate you having me on, and really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I'll keep following the work.
Great. Thank you so much, Eli. I appreciate your time.
All right. Thanks. Yeah, sure. Take care.
All right, back in the studio. My thanks to Eli Saslow. Truly one of the best journalists in this country. I really appreciate his time. His work speaks for itself, especially on tragedy and on the American middle class. He's really a brilliant journalist, and I was being honest. I wish SI had hired him. I don't think he would have stayed here, but it would have been cool to have him in our pages for a couple of years. But hopefully you enjoyed that. That was it's a little different than the traditional straight sports media subjects that we do. But Eli does sports feature writing, so I thought he'd be an interesting guest. We have some really good guests coming up over the next couple of weeks. Rich Eisen is coming up. We have two sports TV agents who will talk about the business. We'll see how honest they are, but that could be really interesting. And I'm Rember Brown from New York Magazine. We haven't landed a date yet, but he tells me he's agreed to do this. So we'll try to pin him down as well. My thanks to Neil Leifer. The previous interview prior to this one, the acclaimed photographer for Sports Illustrated in Time, who talked about his lifelong friendship with Muhammad Ali and his photos. All right, let me thank everybody. Thank you to Eli Saslow, our guest. Thanks to Alan Kim, my producer. Bette Marston, my other producer. Ryan Hunt, Paul Fichtenbaum, Chris Stone, John Wertheim, Dan Bloom of Panoply. This is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network, the number one daily sports podcast network? Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.